Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers, or at least not to piss them off too much. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics you'd like covered or guests we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you are subscribed to and or following NIMSY Insights on your platform of choice. We're coming to you live today on LinkedIn, X, Facebook, and YouTube, of course, where all of our old episodes, as well as a bunch of other great resources, free workshops, research summaries, stuff like that, all of that's archived over on the NIMSY Insights YouTube channel. So if you're not subscribed to that, I would highly recommend it to keep informed about the industry. Today, we're diving into one of the most important skills for localization leaders, storytelling. We all know that having the right data and strategy isn't always enough. What really moves the needle is how well you can tell the story. Whether you're pitching to executives, advocating for budget, or making localization visible across your company, the ability to connect your work to broader business goals is what makes people listen and take action. To explore this topic, I'm joined by Wada Fahel. Wada is a content tech and localization consultant with 2 decades of experience leading strategies for brands like Harley Davidson, Zendesk, and Xerox. She's passionate about reimagining localization as a true business driver, and she's one of the experts behind the Storytelling for Executive Influence workshop offered by NIMSY Insights, where localization professionals learn to captivate, persuade, and inspire action at the highest levels. Wada, welcome to NIMSY Live. So good to have you.
Hi, Doctor. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and this is actually the first time that we're talking. Because I've seen your face all over the internet, especially since you've started this workshop because NIMSY's promoting it. So I see you all over the place. I've been talking about you with my marketing team and all that stuff. I just haven't gotten the chance to talk to you. So I'm really excited.
It's certainly overdue.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's not bury the lead here. The reason we're talking today is because you've been offering this workshop, Storytelling for Executive Influence. And for those of you that want to find out more about that, of course, you can go over to NIMSY.com. And if you go to services, localization, it's hidden here somewhere, localization and program consulting, storytelling workshop. You can find out more information about it. We have a nice little landing page here. And you see the dates where we're offering this. And you can reserve your spot now, and they're filling up pretty darn quick. There are also sponsorship opportunities for companies that want to, vendor side companies that want to sponsor it. So that's the reason we're talking today. And I've heard really good things from a lot of people about this workshop. People are really quite amazed at this workshop. So I figured it's time to get you on the show, and maybe you can share some of that insight with us.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I'm very excited about this workshop. But now, obviously, it's in progress. Chris has already kicked off the European one, and the turnout has been great. And he basically set the stage for us. I'm leading the one in October, happening right after Loc World, actually, and in San Francisco. And we have some great content there. As you mentioned, I'm very passionate about storytelling because that's pretty much what got me through cutthroat environments and localization, especially on the manufacturing side or in the Midwest, where localization is not quite as prevalent as it is on the West Coast. So I'm quite passionate about this topic, and I'm bringing real-time experience, real-time stories, basically all of the bricks that were thrown at me to build the strong foundation.
Well, and you have the experience. You've been working on the client side. And let's just be clear, this workshop is really, I mean, I think anyone can benefit from storytelling skills.
Oh,
and we'll get into what that means in the course of this conversation. But really what this workshop's targeted towards is helping other client side localization leaders. That's your background. That's where you come from. So, I mean, you've worked for Harley Davidson, Zendesk, these brands that we've all heard of before. Maybe you could tell us a little bit What was the role of storytelling when you worked for these big companies, and how did that help you?
Certainly. So let's start with Harley Davidson, for example. It's an American icon going global. It's not a global brand. There's a big difference. And when you work for an American icon, it's all about the story of the product, the Americana of the brand, the culture, or the cult, if you will. So there was a storytelling DNA built into Harley Davidson when I started there. It's all about the open road, the freedom of the open road, riding stories, engaging the audience, the riders. And I realized that the best way for me to engage with various cross-functional capabilities and educate them about localization was to through storytelling, and it has to come across as authentic and effective. So instead of sharing metrics are important, don't get me wrong, and I'm a KPI person. I've leveraged metrics throughout my career, but I spent a lot of time understanding the various functions around the organization, from compliance to dealer training to marketing, all the way to technical publication, and then aligned my story or the localization story to the pain points and everything that they were going through daily. Take an example happening at a certain market, or let's say inside the dealership, a package or a label that is going wrong. Take that story and turn it into a success story through localization. These small steps, quick wins, if you will, led to a long-term compounding effect because it became a word of mouth around the organization. We solved small problems. It became a word of mouth. More divisions learned about what we did, invited us to the table, and we kept on building upon this platform until we were able to expand across 96 markets, 52 languages back then, and we were able to centralize all localization operations under one function, and that was globalization.
And that's kind of amazing. I can't tell you, I've never worked on the client side, right? I've worked with a lot of client side, especially at my tenure here at NIMSY for the last 8 years, you know, consulting, right, client side people. But my background pre-NIMSY was vendor side, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's always, I can't tell you how many times I've worked with a localization leader on the client side whose goal was centralization of the localization function.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah, it's a righteous goal. Right. There's mm-hmm. a lot of efficiencies. There's a lot of good things that happen when you're able to centralize localization function. A lot of those people that I've worked with were not successful. So mm-hmm. that's kind of a testament right there to the power of being able to not just say, hey, this is a good idea, here's some data about it, but to be able to tell a story around it.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, let's maybe back up a little bit. When we're talking about storytelling,
mm-hmm.
what is storytelling? What do we mean by that? What's the difference between right. storytelling and just presenting data, or in your own words?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Well, I mean, if you look at storytelling, it's one of the oldest human practices, right? Before writing, people used to gather and tell stories to probably retain and grow memory, or share values, or explain the world around them. So that was storytelling. Now in business, it evolved and it became a practice because you're literally translating complex ideas and data and strategies into narratives, structured narratives that connect and engage with the leadership and hopefully lead to action. So you're simplifying, you're engaging, you're connecting, and you're rallying an entire organization towards a common goal. And that happens when people relate to you. So I always say that storytelling is about relatability. When people relate to what you're referring to, or what you're sharing or talking about, they're curious. And when they're curious, they want to learn more. And when they learn more, then you start building credibility and rapport. Now, there is a misconception about storytelling that it's a one-time kind of a deal. You pitch in front of the senior leadership, you present your case, your business case, and you try to earn budget, and it's not. What I learned throughout my career, that storytelling is a nurture strategy. A nurture strategy, just like in marketing. You plant the seed, you build upon it, and you work over month and month to build credibility. until the time comes and you have to stand in front of E-staff and C-staff and present your pitch. By that time, you should have already established yourself. People, you're visible. People understand what you do. There's a level of trust. They don't have to fully understand what you do, but if there's trust and credibility, that's going to lead to curiosity and engagement and relatability. And I also want to stress that visibility and support are two different things. People think that, okay, visibility means support. I can't tell you, Tucker, how many loud people I encountered throughout my career, quite visible around the organization, but they never had support. Support is actually credibility. People trust you. They know that you're going to deliver. They don't have to fully understand what you do, but they're curious and they want to learn more. And if you have something to offer, they'll listen. And this is where storytelling comes in.
Well, and that's, you know, having something to offer, it's crucial. You need to be able to add value, right? And that's what I always tell. I probably gave you the pitch 15 minutes ago when we first logged in. It's like my two rules for the podcast is have fun and add value. That's it, right? But adding value is absolutely crucial, no matter what you're doing. And I feel, it's not that I feel, I've observed a lot of times localization managers lecture and educate. Have you ever heard this? You hear this a lot on the vendor side. So here's where my vendor side experience comes in. I can't tell you how many times someone on the vendor side has told me, we need to educate the client, right? The client is not, and to be fair, a lot of times the client is not a localization expert. They just got put in charge of localization for whatever reason. And so the vendor feels the need to educate the client. I hate that term because it's to me, it's pretentious. It's putting yourself above the client. And I also hear it on the client side, you know, like localization years, we need to educate our stakeholders on how to do localization. And you're not wrong in the fact that your stakeholders don't know much about localization, but I think it's presumptuous to put the burden on them and say, you need to learn about how to work with us rather than saying, hey, we're awesome. How can we help better help serve you?
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. And I'm with you. I've never used the term educate. I'd like to say evangelize. And there's a trend in the industry throughout the years. There's a lamenting mentality, like we're the afterthought. Nobody's paying attention to us. Nobody consider us in the full life cycle of a project. And I think it is a victim mentality that we need to get over.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to say. It's a victim. Because, I mean, not to say it's not true, right?
It's not true. It's but true. What are we doing?
Exactly.
Okay, but what are we doing to fill that gap? My role in part of storytelling and educating is to also be curious about my audience and understand exactly what they're doing and what their pain points are. And this is what I've done throughout my career. When I'm sitting with the compliance people, I'm not just learning about due diligence and governance and so forth and so on. I'm actually digging deeper into their contracts and finding some blind spots that, because it's not their core competency, they could not catch this issue. I'm going to give you a specific example here. We had an issue in Canada that dates back to my days with Harley Davidson. So there was this misconception that because Canada is a sub-market subsidiary, we don't have to translate because they're responsible for their translation and their contract. So I took the initiative with my team to dig deeper and look at the Canadian laws when it came to translations. And it turns out that even if your subsidiary and your or your agent is tasked with translation in their contract, the country will find the brand, the big logo, if the translation goes wrong. So they were not going to capture this issue because localization is not their core competency. So it was on me as a thought leader to come in and say, have you noticed or have you read this law? And maybe it's a blind spot because the lawyer or the legal entity could not capture this without obviously while avoiding any accusatory tone. But it's these blind spots, it's on us localization folks, part of the organization, to dig deeper, try to identify them, and then provide the solution to your compliance folks, to your marketing folks, and so forth and so on. So yes, localization is a highly specialized area. It's an afterthought. It's not very sexy and people are not interested in learning about it. What are we doing to change this mindset around the organization? And this is where you come in and rock that boat by providing thought leadership and bridging all of the gaps that or the pain points that may or may have not occurred and present them as preventive actions. It's also about how you present the issue. For example, you can say, you're going to be defined as a big logo or as a power brand. But instead of saying that bluntly, you could say, if we launch the website in English and the language law enforcement in Quebec access the website and finds this issue, we will be fined $2 million and maybe three dealerships will be shut down. That's equivalent to XXX in million dollars loss of sales.
Hmm. Well,
that's it.
And now you're bringing in the data component of it, right? Because data is powerful. Mm-hmm. And I've facilitated workshops around storytelling. I think I have a workshop called, probably archived on our YouTube channel, called Data Driven Storytelling, right?
Right.
And it's largely focused on KPIs. And we get, mm-hmm. the focus of that is more on KPIs and data and metrics and all that stuff. Miguel Sepulveda is another great resource. Mm-hmm. He works with NIMSY. He works with King.
Yeah.
He does a lot of work around that. Is he one of your co-presenters? He is. He's he's on the website.
Yes. Okay. We're partnering.
I did not plan that. I just thought of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Miguel, Chris, and Wada. Yeah. So I should have called that out. I'm sorry. It's not just Wada. We need to give credit where credit's due. There's lots of experts that contribute to this, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
But yeah, data is very powerful. Right? Data is very powerful. Now, it has to be the right data. It has to be data mm-hmm. that matters. And Miguel talks about this in his workshops that I've stolen from him and presented myself. He talks about this, you know, bridging the strategic and the operational, right? Mm-hmm. And in between that operational and that strategic, that's that leadership gap there where, okay, how do we want to report on operational KPIs? Localization leaders, we're obsessed with KPIs like LQA scores. Mm-hmm. And one thing I always say is nobody gives a shit about your LQA scores.
Exactly. Music to my ears.
They just don't, right? Now, I'm not saying, hear me, comment section. I'm not saying LQA scores aren't important. I'm just saying nobody gives a shit about them other than you, right?
It's irrelevant,
right? Mm-hmm. So how do you walk that line? Because let's say you have a spectrum. On one end, you have, you know, data. And some corporate cultures are extremely data-driven, you know, like Amazon. You know, some companies, you just need to have that data. And on the other side is like used car salesman fluff storytelling, right? How do you find the balance between those?
Absolutely. Now, I can assert to you that throughout my career, I never used any localization mumbo jumbo when relaying KPIs. So for compliance, our metric was fines, but we worked by elimination. If for a full quarter or for a full year, we did not get any fines in any country, high law enforcement governance, then we're doing a great job. Sometimes you work by elimination. So that was my KPI there. When you're addressing marketing folks, it's the churn rate. It's the traffic to the website. It is the cost of customer acquisition when you're addressing the sales folks. So our KPIs were aligned fully with each division's KPI. And then you go from there, because I go back to the topic of relatability. We need to leverage the language of our audience. Now, there are two KPIs that are also common threads with localization, and that's cost reduction and time to market. Mm-hmm. Because in the industry, now we've effectively moved from fast enough to real time. And with AI and with localization, we're able to touch on this. I think we have a very strong foundation in localization to play the game of real time localization.
I just want to call out, that we've gone 20 minutes without bringing up AI. I think that's a record.
I
play this little game. Sorry. I play this little game with myself every podcast. I'm like, how long until someone mentions AI? I think 20 minutes, that's a long time. So we've made it this far, but now we got to talk about it, right?
Right.
Well, so, and we got to talk about it because I think AI is blurring a lot of the lines between localization and other functions, right?
Absolutely.
And what I love this industry. I love the people of this industry. I love everything about it. I love languages. I'm very passionate about this industry. So please don't take this the wrong way, but we really suck at some things. And one of those things that we suck at is seizing opportunities when they come up, right? Back to COVID, the entire world went remote overnight. Our industry has been remote for decades, right? And like that was an opportunity for us to leverage a core skill set that our industry, we didn't do anything with it, right? Now AI is coming on the scene. Large language models. It's right there in the name.
Yes.
Language, LLMs. Right? Mm-hmm. And there are, not everybody, but there are a lot of LSPs on the vendor side. There are a lot of client-side localization programs that are not seizing this opportunity. And my prediction is what that means is they're going to become irrelevant because for the first time, I think a lot of localization programs have survived over the years because they are that necessary evil, right? Mm-hmm. They're that checkbox, right? Once the marketing department figures out how they can use AI to do their own localization without relying upon a separate department that's going to be bugging them about things like LQA scores and fuzzy matches, they're going to do it, right? So this is the opportunity that we have as an industry. We need to start encroaching on other territory before other territory starts encroaching on us. And I'm sorry, that I'll get off my soapbox, but I just had to interject that.
No, this is you're onto something very specific and very precise. I think as an industry, yes, to your point, there are a lot of things that need to change. I've always been unorthodox in my approach on the buyer side because we did not have the tools and resources from the industry to support us internally. So we had to come up with our own approach. And sometimes your background helps. So my background is in international business. So adding that to localization, I think most of the people on the buyer side do not have a localization background. It kind of gets us. And we end up inheriting it and we fall in love with it, especially if you come from an international background and you feel that you're in your natural habitat, but you're not.
A lot of people end up with localization roles at company because they're former linguists, which I love my linguists out there, but linguists are obsessed with quality in language and the art, let's say, of it, and sometimes aren't thinking about the business side. Right. So
if you're on the buyer side, you've got to have a strategic mindset. Operation is good. So you have to have this nice balance. You be able to let's say, balance opposite abilities. You're strategic, but you're not afraid of getting in the weeds. You're bold, but empathetic. So you've got to balance these opposite abilities when you're leading localization on the client side. But yes, to your point, I want to go back to the seizing opportunity. We're very bad at seizing opportunities and also predicting the future. And there's a lamenting and a victim mentality all the time and blaming the client, which is a problem. So and there's a panic mode. For example, AI is going to replace X, Y, and Z. Yes. And it's not just in localization. It's across the board. Yeah. So how are you shifting gears? How are you evolving? We went through this at Zendesk, for example. AI took the industries by storm during COVID, while the entire, and what helped us get through this environment was we were very consistent, we were credible, but we were also faster than anyone else. By the time the others were putting the meeting on the calendar and trying to figure out how to think about AI and already scheduling because someone is on PTO, my team and I have already made 5 mistakes and figured out how to roll out 4 AI use cases.
Yeah.
Okay. Shifting gears. And okay, it's we're going to eliminate a lot of tasks right now. I'm going to evolve my team members from being heavy lifters and doing the daily grind to becoming thought leaders and spending more time with the stakeholders and also with vendors. Instead of you being the heavy lifter, now you're going to be the in-country reviewer or the gatekeeper. Yeah. Again, I feel that we get stuck instead of, and we operate in a panic mode, instead of pausing, assessing, looking at what we have, and shifting gears. That is the greatest opportunity. Now, we also don't want to be delusional and say, oh, AI is not taking roles away. It is.
Yeah.
But also new roles are being created. Now we need agents, prompt agents and localization. Now we need content generators, for example, because your point earlier around the marketing team. Now my regional leads or marketing folks in the region only need a solid storyboard and an outline, and they can leverage the latest and greatest smart tech tool to launch their campaign. Great. I don't want to be even associated with it because it's a pain and it's a high touch, and the profit margin is not even a wash.
Yeah. No.
So why not look at the positive things and focus on them?
And I think the companies of today, and it's always interesting to remind ourselves that the biggest companies with the biggest localization budgets today, the top 10 companies, most of them, well, I'm making stuff up here, but the sentiment remains. Most of them did not exist 20 years ago, right? Mm-hmm.
That's a fair assessment.
So 20 years from now, who are the biggest companies going to be, right? It's going to be companies that you've never heard of before. And I would say that existing companies are at a strategic disadvantage in the AI revolution. Why? Because they are scrambling to figure out how to implement AI to evolve their practices. Whereas if I have a startup today, I can build it from day one with those best practices, right? So I'm not Absolutely. Having to go back and replace stuff and break stuff. I can just build it that way. So that's mm-hmm. what we're up against. And we see it on the vendor side too. New companies starting us, particularly in the tech side, right? There's a lot of exciting stuff happening on the tech side in the mm-hmm. supply chain in our industry. And the newer companies are kind of at an advantage when it comes to this stuff because they can move fast and break things, as Google likes
to say. They can. They can, but sometimes you also want to wait for the dust to settle.
Yeah.
So, for example, when the LLMs took the industries by storm and the companies thought that, well, I don't need an agency anymore. I can hire one person and they can run my internal LLM.
Yeah.
And that backfired bigly because they realized that one person cannot manage 96 languages.
Right.
So they went back to the agencies and asked for support. So the we need to learn how to navigate these waters. I don't think the dust have settled yet, to be
Not
honest.
Completely. No, it's starting to.
There's a light at the end of the, I don't want to say tunnel, but the horizon.
Yeah.
But it hasn't settled yet. The agencies are needed. Copywriters are needed. The roles, new roles will be created. And yes, we have to develop and we have to earn a seat at the table by learning how these new roles function.
Yep.
And you don't have to be an engineer or a computer scientist. You just have to be technical enough to be dangerous.
You just have to know more than the guy sitting next to you.
Absolutely. Right? And think outside the TMS radius.
And you know, because you know what irritates?
They're stuck in the TMS. In a few years from now, they won't be anything called TMS anymore. It's going to have a different name.
Well, in my mind, TMS and MT are already one thing in my mind. It's one tool set.
Absolutely. Right? Well, I mean,
and now we're going to add TMS, MT, and LLMs, and generative AI. It's all just technology. It's merging together.
Absolutely. And
it irritates me when I talk to people. I get like physically irritated when I talk to people. They're like, oh, AI, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, what do you use AI for? Have you played around mm-hmm. with ChatGPT? Oh, I haven't played around with ChatGPT at all. I'm like,
exactly. Like the defensiveness and the risk. I don't call it risk averse. It's actually not very smart to explore, but you see the blind spots. To your point, the lack of seizing the opportunity. Any TMS right now integrates with a wealth of apps that are within reach. You can learn how they function. You can learn how they work from Figma to Canva to AEM to Workfront. They integrate with the TMS. By learning how these tools work, you've already evolved as a localization professional and you come across as a thought leader when you're addressing your client. You don't see that happening in the industry. And it's literally available for you to leverage for free.
And there's a lot of good information out there. I mean, plug for nimsy.com. Go check it out, right?
Yes.
I say, you know, if you are new to this industry and you have a subscription to Multilingual Magazine, it comes once a month. It's not that big, right? You read Multilingual Magazine. I'm a shameless plug because I own Multilingual Magazine too, right? But it's true. I'll plug someone else. Slater. Slater provides news.
You're a good storyteller.
Yeah, I'll plug my competitors, right? Read stuff from Slater. They also publish daily news. Yeah. So does multilingual.com, by the way. You read Nimsy. You listen to podcasts, whether it's Nimsy Live or whatever other podcasts, right? You just do a bare minimum to educate yourself on an ongoing basis because things are changing quickly. Then you will be smarter than the guy next to you. And that's all. It's the old adage about, you know, being chased by a bear in the woods. You don't need to outrun the bear. You just need to outrun the guy next to you. It's kind of like that. You want to keep your job, outrun the guy next to you. Mm-hmm. Right. Going back, we talked about KPIs and storytelling and stuff. And I got to bring it up because it's what I call and many people call the holy grail of localization is being able to track and report on return on investment. Return on localization investments. Thoughts. Is this possible? If so, absolutely. How? Because I'll give you my standard answer when people ask me about this, which is like, it's possible. You got to make a number of assumptions, right? You got to be bold with the assumptions that you make. You got to make friends with whoever owns the data, you know, whoever has access to the Google Analytics account, you know, take them out for coffee. So you really got to make sure that you have access to the right data. You're going to have to make some assumptions to build into your calculations. And it's never going to be perfect, but it's going to be something. Is kind of my 2 cents on it. What are your thoughts on reporting on ROI?
It has to be punchy and credible. So to give you some examples, and I think I touched on this earlier, for example, in the space of compliance, if for a full year you have been fined nonstop in Germany or in Canada or in any high law enforcement market, and then when you started localizing efficiently and consistently, fines were reduced by X percentage, then that's a KPI right there. You calculate the amount, the dollar amount by of fines, and you tie it to the success. That's a KPI right there. The other thing is working by elimination. So this is actually a good story we had in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, where the team wanted to move the market from tier two to tier one, right? Because they were producing very well. They thought they deserved the seat at the table in tier one. They met all of the KPIs, but then they were also asking for more localization budget. And the leadership was on and off. Oh, how can you tell that because of localization, you were able to increase your sales? And our suggestion was, okay, let's stop localizing, let's say helmets. You're in a brick and mortar environment, so you can control that. Let's stop localizing helmets packaging and labeling or the ads that you have inside in a brick and mortar environment for just one quarter and measure the return on investment or measure the sales. And sure enough, sales dropped because the user experience, the CX experience, the client experience was not there. So that's a direct impact, and it's punchy and it's credible. Because when you removed localization from the equation, you suffered. I think we tend to focus on how we demonstrate how localization added, but sometimes you have to reverse engineer it. What happens when you stop localizing in an X market? Now, of course, this is a risk that you have to afford. Right. And that comes when you have a strong relationship with the regional lead and they trust you and they're willing to take that step with you. Because you've built that relationship through storytelling, through nurturing them over the years. So working by elimination is a good KPI. Traffic to the website, absolutely, you can tie localization. This website wouldn't even exist in a locale without localization. So 100% traffic is the website conversions are localization metrics that you want to leverage. So these are the areas. So we can talk about this for hours, whether it's a digital service as well. But the idea that there are no credible or tangible KPIs that relate to revenue or the cost of customer acquisition is not true. You just have to spend a lot of time deep diving the lay of the land on your client side and understand what each department does, what the pain points are, and how they calculate revenue. And tie your localization efforts to that. And sometimes you don't want to be even associated with a market. Mm-hmm. I am willing to forego a market because it's not set up properly and maybe localization will come across as a cost center and as a pain point. I'll wait for it to get settled and figure things out, and then I'll contribute with localization efforts. So sometimes you have to be willing to say no.
Yeah. And all of these, I mean, you gave a couple examples here. I have a feeling, as you say, we could talk about this for a couple hours. And if I asked you for 10 more examples, I think they'd all have one thing in common, is that they have little to do with fuzzy matches and per word rates and glossaries. All of these things have to do with stuff that typically doesn't fall under the purview of the localization department, meaning you need to build those relationships, right? Because as a localization director at a client side company, if I go and say, we're going to stop localizing helmets or product A for 3 months. I don't have the authority to do that. That requires buy-in, that requires a relationship, and that requires trust with whoever does have the authority to do that.
And guts, because it could backfire.
And guts, yeah, that's a typical, I mean, there's not a lot of guts to go around. The bigger the company, the thinner the guts, I would say.
Right.
I'm speaking in generalities, but people don't want to put their name on things that might be risky. So, I mean, that brings us really back into, like, why storytelling? Because that's how you get that influence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you have to be authentic. You could be storytelling, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, but a BSer all the time. So, and people, you know, that won't work. But you have to be authentic. You have to be credible.
I don't know. I've worked with a lot of assholes. Not a lot, right? But some people who have worked with me would also say they've worked with an asshole. But it's like, I think assholes, I can work with highly intelligent assholes. I can work with you. Right. But if you're not, like, really moving the needle, you can't be an asshole and be incompetent at the same time. I don't have time for that. Right.
Yeah.
Those assholes, they usually hit a glass ceiling where they're not going any, they're going to get stuck. You know, the Peter principle definitely applies to them. They're going to get stuck at a certain level because they don't have the diplomacy to get what needs to be done politically. I mean, for lack of a better term, there's playing politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of what you got to do.
Absolutely. And they can get away long enough with fluff without substance. But at some point when the real stuff come into play and things are at stake, they will be exposed. I think what helped me throughout my career, again, is being consistent, being fast, but also being authentic. Some people liked it, others didn't. With time, it's paid off. And if you put things on a balance, I have relationships that last for a lifetime now because of the style that I've adopted in my approach when it came to localization. My ultimate goal was not to centralize, but to partner and bring people in because it's a common goal for the organization and it alleviated a lot of the pressure. And then it became word of mouth. And that's what helped tremendously. But storytelling has to be authentic, has to be credible, because people basically don't have time. They don't have time to sit down and listen to something that is irrelevant to their area or is not going to make them look good. What also helps a lot during storytelling, if you're presenting, is building alliances. So even when you're presenting to your E-staff and C-staff leadership, and you know that you can take all the credit you want, but try to give credit to your counterparts, even if they didn't actually contribute 100%. But that grace, that empathy, showing the alliance and the partnership will pay off in the future. They will recognize that, one, you covered for them when they dropped the ball bigly, and two, you were actually gracious enough to acknowledge that they tried.
You're speaking my language here. Like I have a workshop that I do. It's called many different things depending upon who I'm presenting to, but it's basically like communication skills, right? I could even call that a storytelling workshop to a certain extent, because, and it's one of my oldest workshops that I've ever developed. I've been giving the same workshop for 8 years now. What it started out on, it was called Account Management for Project Managers, or Communication Skills for Project Managers. Why? Because in my career, I saw that was one of the biggest things that was holding project managers in our industry from growing in their career, getting to the next level, leveling up their skills and their relationships and their network, was just basic communication skills, right? So that was one of the first workshops I developed. And I talk about all the stuff that you're just talking about, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about, talk about what's important to your stakeholders. Make your stakeholder look good. I have a slide. I could pull it up right now, probably. It says, you have two jobs. Make your stakeholder's life easier and make them look good to their boss. That's mm-hmm. it. Those are your two jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever's in your mm-hmm. job description, that's just a way to get to those, right?
Yeah, and you can't go wrong with this approach. It pays off all the time.
And the authenticity aspect. I think authenticity mm-hmm. is so important because it's in short supply, and especially in some company cultures. Supply. And I mean, look, hello, LinkedIn audience. Just go spend 10 minutes on LinkedIn. And I want to barf, right? It's gotten so bad. It's just so inauthentic people are afraid to be themselves. And in my workshop, I have the last section that I talk about is get to know yourself. Who are you? I talk about get to know your clients and stakeholders, get to know your people, your team members, and get to know yourself, right? Because a lot of people don't even know who they are in this industry. And if you can't authentically show up as yourself, then people aren't going to take you serious. They can smell it. They can smell it, especially those C-level people.
And it's a concern in the industry because we don't do anything to coach and nurture the next generation. Now, some people will not like this, but if you look at academia, I majored in localization at Kent State after I entered the business. I decided that, okay, maybe I need to learn more about it because now it's a little bit different than international business. So I majored there, and the program is great, but it's very technical. Yeah. And it's all about how you get software localization or web localization from A to Z. There wasn't a single class or a session around communication or professional maturity or how you enter a workforce or how you to communicate with various levels around the organization. And I mentor a lot of junior professionals right now because I want to help them get through this. I want to help them be successful, not just execution folks, but also good communicators and reach that level of professional maturity, which I feel is non-existent. And I think we take the blame as an industry, not preparing the next generation of localizers to navigate, because they're not going to be sitting on their computers all the time assessing fuzzy matches or looking at quotes and invoices or mediating files between translators. This is all going to be automated at some point. It's all about communication and professional maturity. And the professional maturity is what makes you a good storyteller as well.
Yep. Preaching to the choir. I mean, I taught at Middlebury Institute down in Monterey, right? And it's just like a weekend course, right? It's like one credit.
Right.
I'm not full-time, I'm adjunct. And that's exactly what I teach and stuff like that. I don't talk about TMSs or, stuff like that, because that stuff's all going to be out of date in a year anyways. And you're going to learn about it your first 3 months on the job anyways, right? Mm-hmm. What I talk about is how to gain credibility, how to build trust with your clients, how to build trust with your team members, right? How to add value, stuff like that. Because you're right, I think that's a lot of the stuff that we're not getting in traditional academia, let's say. So super important, which kind of brings us back. One place, I'm just kind of watching the clock here. I think we can start tying it up, but one place where you can get this is a sign up for WADA's workshop on storytelling. Let's go into, I think we've added value. Let's add that's we've earned the right for to plug the workshop here. So it's Miguel, Chris, and you are tag teaming this. We got one coming up in San Francisco, one coming up in Dublin, and one coming up in Berlin. Now, these are in-person workshops.
Yes, these are in-person workshops. I'm leading the one in San Francisco on October 17th. It's going to be a full day workshop, and it's going to be fun because it's in person. I get to read the audience and the room, which is something that you can do when you're mentoring online or when you're providing a workshop online. So I'm super excited about it.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. For like, why in person? Like, I know why, because we've lost the passion for in person, you know, ever since the dark times, at the beginning of this decade, everything's gone remote. And we all whistle to ourselves saying that this is a good thing that everything's remote. And there are a lot of good things about it for
Of course.
accessibility and, you know, equitability thing. There are great things about it, but there's also, oh, we'd be kidding ourselves if we pretended like remote learning, remote workshops, all of that stuff. We'd be kidding ourselves if we said it was better categorically than in person. So what was the decision to do this in person instead of just hosting some webinars online?
Well, proximity is one reason. The locations that were selected by the NIMSY team are quite smart because you're able to attract folks from San Francisco or from Dublin or wherever the workshop is taking place. So people are able to reach that location. Also, they are taking place on a Friday, and usually Friday people are checked out at work, so they might as well take a day off and come and work on a development opportunity. And we're offering the same workshop actually online, but in a chunked manner, so 2 hours per session for different clients. But this one specifically, I think the rationale behind it was to start getting people together because storytelling is also relatability. And what is a better way to relate to each other than sitting in the same room, addressing storytelling, role-playing storytelling, pressure testing each other, handling objections and rejections in a storytelling setup? Now, obviously, you can do all this online. But at the end of the day, when you're pitching to your leadership, when stakes are high, you're going to be in person. And you have to be accustomed from a body language perspective, from a tone perspective, from a reading the room perspective to all of these pressures. So I'm a firm believer that an in-person workshop has great value. And not to discount the online workshop, of course, you're going to get the same level of thought leadership and pressure testing and everything. We're doing the same online, exact same online. But when you're in person, we can chat during the break. We can understand each other more. We can relate to each other more. And I'm guarantee you, Tucker, that some things that were not planned will surface during this workshop just because we were in person.
Yes, and it's building those relationships that you were talking about is so important. It's not just important to build relationships in your organization. You got to build relationships in this industry because one day you might want a
Certainly.
job, right? Right? Let's be
Well, and look at the partnerships that are currently happening. I never thought that we would have a vendor-to-vendor partnerships growing, but AI pushed us and pushed us, and now you have competitors partnering and complementing each other's services and technology because the industry needs it. So that's part of also expanding your sphere of influence in the industry and outside and presenting yourself as one front vis-à-vis the clients.
Yeah, no, and you know, I was up on my soapbox earlier talking about how much I love this industry. I criticize the industry because I love it, right? And the one thing I love about it is just the relationships. It's a very people-driven industry. We got Loke World coming up. You're in San Francisco October 17th, so I'm assuming we'll see you in Monterey.
Yeah, I'm going to be in Loke World too. I'm not attending Loke World, but I'm going to be there because I have some clients meetings.
Yeah, kind of the same here. You might see me bopping around a little bit on Wednesday, but I'll definitely be down there. Why? Because that's where all my friends are.
Exactly.
I've been in this industry.
For all of us.
Yeah, it's like, and I joke about, you know, I've got, you know Michael Stevens. Everyone knows Michael Stevens, right? So Michael Stevens lives 15 minutes away from me. When do I get to have lunch with them? In Dublin, in Monterey, in different time zones.
You gotta do better.
You know what I'm saying? I know. actually, I am going to lunch with Michael on October 4th, I think. I think we did set it up. But yeah, these industry events are there when we get to get together, exchange ideas, build relationships, and I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Absolutely. Same here. Whenever there's an opportunity. Now, I'm a little bit biased because, you know, I'm a golfer and Pebble Beach is right by the world. So it's also an excuse to get there. But it's a one-stop shop and you get to connect with everyone. And if you're driving from San Francisco, it's a great ride. Taking Highway 1, I make sure to do it every time. But I'm looking forward to it. And then the workshop will be right after Loke World, just to energize people with some development opportunities. And it's only a two-hour drive.
Yeah, is that Uber, right, in San Jose campus?
It's at Uber, yes. The details will be posted to the website, like the exact, because they have multiple buildings in the headquarters.
Was I not supposed to say that? Sorry.
Yes, and I think there's construction there, but it's only a two-hour drive from Monterey. I'm going to be driving back on the 16th and looking forward to the 17th.
Very cool. Well, Wada, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Any closing thoughts before I close us up? The floor is yours.
Oh, well, I mean, lots of thoughts flying around. From a storytelling perspective, again, as we discussed, it does not have to do with localization specifically. You need this as a professional for relatability purposes, to build confidence and rapport, and to connect and engage with people. So even if you're not a localization professional, I'd highly recommend attending this workshop because we're offering practical experiences. There are plenty of great books out there, master classes that you can sign up to and learn how to storytell. But what I'm bringing is real life practical experiences and examples and how we handle them in cutthroat environment. And these are quite beneficial stories and engaging stories. So I hope to see a good turnout on October 17th. And also, if this succeeds, I think the plan is to also go online if people cannot attend in person. Final thought on the industry, I think we've got to have a bias towards time as industry folks, because we've effectively moved, as I said, from fast enough to real time. And I think we have all of the ingredients to succeed as an industry. We just have to put things together, look at the blind spots, seize the opportunity, to your point, and shorten that time between thinking and executing. I can't tell you how many times I dreaded that statement from a vendor saying, I'll get back to you in 3-4 weeks. This is where money and opportunities and dreams go to die. And we cannot afford this anymore in the industry. I'm seeing this working with clients and vendors constantly. If you want to win, you've got to have bias towards time and shorten that period between thinking and executing. So those would be my final thoughts on storytelling and the industry.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking, well, you're the best person for this workshop is from a storytelling perspective. So after that pitch, I want to sign up for the workshop. Unfortunately, I won't be there on Friday. I got to come back to Seattle.
I would love to get your feedback on it. But yeah, no, it's going to be a tough act to follow after Chris. I know he delivered a great workshop, and we're just
I've heard it was top notch. So well done, Chris. If this ever gets back to you, so thank you, Wada. I'm going to close us out here. Stick around. Just let me close this up, ladies, gentlemen, chat. We are out of time for today. So if you enjoyed this NIMSY Live experience, and join us next time. Actually, I don't think we have anything on the calendar right now. Hey, heck, join us next time in Monterey, localization world. I'll be there. Wada's going to be there bopping around. We have a bunch of people from NIMSY going down, so I hope to see you there if you're a local world person. I appreciate our guest today, Wada. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSY Insights doing all of the hard work so I can have these interesting conversations. And I appreciate you, the audience, joining us live today. And I look forward to next time. Cheers.